This is episode 4 of the Nothing Human podcast. Three Powers of the Human Spirit, part 4. The Powers, Ordered and Disordered.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to the Nothing Human podcast, a biblically informed think space for exploring and articulating all the ways we make or break sense of human experience. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. From my youngest days, I have been fascinated with categories of thought, those often unconscious filing mechanisms that invisibly populate our premises, direct our inquiries, and ordain our conclusions. Join me as we investigate and interrogate our assumptions in an effort to articulate a more cohesive understanding of human information within the superstructure of God's truth. Hi, welcome back to the Nothing Human podcast. Last episode, I promised you that we would talk about the disordered powers today, and I plan to get to that. But before I can do that, I really need to talk about the well-ordered powers, because I don't really want to focus on talking about counterfeits if I haven't really given you some picture of what the true and healthy powers look like. And these are very much connected to the interaction of the human spirit with the Holy Spirit in a process of sanctification. And when we're truly in communion, we can see that there are fruit of the Holy Spirit that are produced in us. And so I want to start with a discussion of that. I first began to notice something interesting about the fruit of the Spirit when I was reading through Galatians 5 one time. And I noticed that the fruit of the Spirit are 9. And unlike the works of the flesh, where he says, and things like these at the end of it, the fruit of the Spirit didn't have something like that. So it seemed like perhaps Paul believed that he had covered a plenary, a plenary set of categories for the fruit of the Spirit, meaning he had completed at least placeholders for the fruit of the Spirit in a very comprehensive or an exhaustive way. And the fruit of the Spirit, as you read them in Galatians 5, are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. When I first started looking at it, I said, okay, well, there are 9. And interestingly, you know, 9 is 3 by 3. So I wondered if there was some relationship to the realities of the powers of the Spirit embedded in this plenary category set of the fruit of the Spirit. And then I noticed in Ephesians 5, a different letter from Paul, that he says the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. So he uses this, it's an aside, it's in a parenthesis in most of your English translations in Ephesians 5 verse 9, to talk about the fruit of the light, and the fruit of the Spirit is similar to the fruit of the light, and he categorizes the fruit of the light in these three terms, goodness, righteousness, and truth. And if you look at those, goodness, righteousness, and truth, they relate pretty closely to what you would say as the goal of the affections, goodness, the goal of the will, righteousness, and the goal of the intellect, truth. And so I wondered if the fruit of the Spirit had a similar three-part structure. And if you do a power mapping of the fruit of the Spirit, I began to realize that there's three sets of three here, and they do actually seem to connect to goodness and then righteousness and then truth. If you think of love, joy, and peace as the fruit of the affections, patience, kindness, and goodness as the fruit of the will, and faith, gentleness, and self-control as the fruit of the intellect. If you know this, the word for faith or faithfulness in the New Testament as well as the Old Testament is only one word. It's faith and faithfulness. It's translated either way depending on your context. And so if you're looking at emuna in the Hebrew, that could mean faith or faithfulness. And if you're looking at pistis in the New Testament in Greek, that could be either faith or faithfulness. So even though the fruit of the Spirit usually is translated faithfulness there, the word is just pistis in the New Testament in the Greek in Galatians 5. So it could actually just be faith rather than faithfulness. And we'll talk about why that's important when we get to it. But what I realized in looking over these nine fruit is that they do seem to be organized according to goodness and then righteousness and truth. In other words, they seem to be organized in terms of the fruit of the affections and then the fruit of the will and then the fruit of the intellect. So the fruit of the affections, love, joy, and peace. Love is the central function of the affections, and joy and peace are what are created in the affections by the service of the other powers. And this is interesting because you know that love rejoices in the truth. So joy seems to be how the affections respond to the truth when they're properly ordered, and peace or wholeness seems to be how the affections respond when the will is serving the affections. So love, joy, and peace, they're all three things that happen in the affections, but joy and peace are the two things that happen in the affections when they are properly responding to the service of the intellect and the will. If you look at the next grouping of three, patience, kindness, and goodness, you'll see that patience is the central power or the central function of the will. And this could be hope or perseverance as well. It's sometimes translated different ways depending on what's being talked about. And that kindness is what happens when the will submits itself to the service of the affections. And that goodness is what happens in the will when it submits itself to the service of the intellect. And then you can see with the fruit of the intellect that you have faith, gentleness, and self-control. So faith, believing or knowing, is the central function of the intellect. Gentleness or meekness is what happens when you have the intellect submitting itself to the service of the affections. And self-control or self-discipline is what happens when the intellect is submitting itself to the service of the will. So Paul talks about faith, hope, and love in another place in Corinthians as that which remains. These three things remain. And he says the greatest of these is love. Interestingly, that is also the first of the mappings of the fruit in the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, and peace. So Paul, in all of these various different letters, seems to understand these three powers and the mapping of these three powers in their relationship, proper relationship to the Spirit of God, how the Spirit of God operates within a person to produce these fruits. And I know it might be a little bit difficult to follow this, especially if you're not really familiar with it off the top of your head. And so I have created a graphic, and again, graphics and visual aids are not really my strong suit, but I have created a graphic that I think is somewhat helpful. And I will include that graphic in the show notes on my website for this particular episode so that you can look at it. And it might help some of you. And if nothing else, you can download it, you can look at it, you can use it, and you can give me some feedback as to whether or not you think these are accurate mappings. I think that they make a whole lot of sense. They make sense of a lot of the things that we read throughout the scriptures concerning the various different fruit of the Spirit and its relationship to the human being. One thing you will notice about these fruit, well, first off, is that it actually is fruit and not fruits, plural, in the Galatians 5 text. So it is not necessarily the case that any particular person is supposed to have only some of these qualities in their lives. If they are in fact united to the Holy Spirit, they will be expressing every aspect of this fruit. So you can think of the fruit as being an orange, and each of the facets of the fruit are the segments of an orange. So it's still one orange, one fruit, but it has different facets or different segments. It's also interesting to note that the powers are in submission to one another and in service to one another in this mapping of the fruit, meaning at no point is it supposed to be the case that a power is operating independently of the other powers. So I'm not making a separation between the three powers. Throughout this series, I think it's important to understand I'm making a distinction. It is distinct, and you're able to talk about these different facets and different distinctions, but at no point is it ever supposed to be separate. In fact, when we get to talking about abuses and disorders in the powers, we will note that the attempt of any individual power to become primary or exclusive is part of what creates disorders in the person. The powers are meant to submit to one another. They're meant to serve one another. you are probably, as an individual, going to have, like we said, a lead power, a partner power, and a subject power. But this does not mean that one is supposed to lord it over the others, or that they're not all, to whatever extent, in submission and service to one another. And there are many circumstances, obviously, where one has to take the back seat and the other has to operate as the more functional primary, and this depends on the circumstances and the need of the moment. What truly does orient the properly ordered powers is love of God and love of others. So the human being is meant to be turned outward toward the service and love of other people. And in the same way, even within himself, each of his powers is meant to be turned outward to the service and love and care of the other powers. So if you do have this subject power, and there's going to be weakness there, usually your subject power is your weakest power relative to your other powers. So it is going to need to be served and cared for and lifted up in dignity and built up by the other powers. And one of the things that means is that it has to be submitted to, especially in circumstances where in our weakness, we have to rely on the grace and the Spirit of God. And what that means for the Christian is oftentimes your weakest power becomes your most significant power, the power that really makes the difference in your life. As Paul says, again, in other places, that in our weakness, God's strength is perfected, which means that there are times, in fact, many times, where your subject power is the one that you need to be most caring for and the one that needs to be lifted up most in dignity. This is not just the case in an individual. This would also be the case in a community. In a community where you have a great strength and where a primary power is almost standardized as the primary power by prescription, almost not even just by description, but by prescription, this should be the primary power. It's oftentimes in those circumstances and in those communities where the subject power really needs to be lifted up in dignity and usefulness in that congregation or in that community, or the community will suffer greatly or become an abusive or exploitative type of community. Another aspect of this mutual submission of the powers, and this definitely connects to the Trinitarian nature of this whole discussion, the fact that we are representatives of God, both as individuals and as communities, that we image God in these ways. And we've already talked about the fact that God, in his persons, co-equal in power and glory, and ultimately unified in nature. So that would also carry for the individual human being and human beings in community with one another. What's interesting is, because of this, it seems like each power in itself, and you can see this in the mapping of the fruit of the Spirit, is meant to display some of the qualities of the other powers, almost as if each power, in a sense, has a certain kind of three-power or three-part structure, even internally. And what this looks like in each individual power is that each individual power has a goal, has a standard, and has a function. So you can think about this with an analogy of trying to get someplace. You need a destination of where you're going to go. That would be your goal. You need a map or a standard that tells you how to get there and whether or not you're in the right place. And you also need a function or a vehicle to get you there, the thing that actually moves you. And each of the powers, of the three powers, has a goal, a standard, and a function, meaning it has a destination of where it's trying to get. It has a map of whether or not it's on the right path and what path it should take. And it also has a function or a vehicle that actually gets it to go there. And those, the goal, standard, and function will differ slightly for each of the powers. With the power of the will, the destination is righteousness, as we've said. The standard, the map, is the law of God, which tells you whether or not you're on the right path. And the function or the vehicle is choice, doing. This also holds for the affections, where the goal is life or ultimate goodness in God. And the standard or the map would be taste, meaning training of your taste, what is good and what is evil. And the function or the vehicle that gets you to that place would be love. And you can also see in the intellect that the goal would be truth. That's the destination you're trying to get to. The standard would be knowledge, in some ways again, kind of truth, and the function would be knowing or naming. So with the well-ordered leader powers, the function for the intellect should be faith, the function for the affections should be love, and the function for the will should be patience or hope. This is what we get from the fruit of the Spirit. In God, these persons are not in conflict at all. In an individual person, because of our sin and because of our limitations, there are going to be conflicts that have to be resolved. And in each case, there are times and circumstances, like I've said before, where one of the powers is going to have to correct or rebuke or interrogate, investigate the other powers in order to determine whether or not you're actually on the right path to the goal you're actually trying to get to, and that you're not abusing the function or the power that you've been granted in each of these powers. So let's talk a little bit more about these functions that we see in the fruit of the Spirit, the main functions. So when it comes to the intellect, this function of faith. Now, I've already talked about how faith is not merely in the intellect. It couldn't be. A person can believe, yes, and that has to do with an intellectual assent. And Western society has focused on that as being kind of the central idea of faith, even to the point of Calvin saying faith is a kind of knowledge. So within the Western tradition, it's not very hard to connect faith and intellect. But I want to mention that the particular idea of faith that Paul has here probably does have to do with intellectual assent, with the agreement of the person with the truth of God. And that, again, this doesn't have to be the fundamental aspect through which we are drawn to God, but it is definitely one of the primary functions of the intellect, to believe, to know through intimacy. And when we talk about the intellect on its own terms, we'll get more into this, because there's a lot of things that we're probably confused about concerning this that we should probably clear up. But for now, I will just say that the intellect has to believe things to be true. That really is the only way we come to truth. We don't come to truth outside of belief. That is just the way that it functions and the way that it works. And so the intellect is interested in the proper naming and the proper reality of things, and it comes to this proper reality through assent to the truth of God as the Spirit communes with us. The affections, in their main function, are love. And I mean, that makes sense. If you're thinking about the affections, most people would say that the primary affection is love. And it encompasses much more than just a fuzzy feeling, because this has to do with the values that the affections have, the value that you have for what is actually good. And it also means that in order to exercise love and to function in love, a person must be oriented toward the value and the benefit of others. The affections become corrupt if the object of the affections is itself. We can tell from 1 Corinthians 13 and other passages concerning love that love is fundamentally selfless. It is fundamentally the giving of oneself. Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life. So you can see here that in some ways, the affections deny even your own good for the sake of the good of others, and that is what we call love. So love is selfless giving of self, or a will for the benefit of others, even at the expense of yourself. And in the will, the primary function of the will is patience or hope. Patience and hope are not interchangeable. There are differences there, obviously, but they are, in some sense, two sides of the same coin. The word for patience in the Greek, makrothume, means long-suffering to some extent, or really long of wrath. The thymus is the, you know, place where wrath comes out. And so macro meaning long or large. And so what it means is that there's a lot of time between an instance where you could express wrath and the actual expression of that wrath. And so that's what patience is. Patience is a refraining from doing what even might be considered a just evil to another person. Hope, on the other hand, has more to do with waiting for a good. So patience is about waiting to deliver a harm, And hope has to do with waiting to receive a good or a benefit. It's interesting that, for the most part, when you start to talk about disorders of the intellect, the affections, and the will, what you find is that the good or the value of the function has been turned inward, and the harm of the function has been turned outward. And it's probably easiest to see this in relationship to hope and patience. If patience is a refraining from doing harm to another and a patient waiting on that, and hope is a patient waiting on a good for yourself, meaning you are delaying good for yourself and you are also delaying harm for others, then you can see how if you were to turn that backwards, so the opposite of patience would be wrath, where you just unload on people as soon as there's any reason to, especially if there's a contradiction to your particular will. And then also you take for yourself whatever good you want with the power that you have through your will. And you can see how that's a complete perversion of the function of the will. All three of these well-ordered powers have to function together in order to produce all of these other fruit that we see, like joy and peace and kindness and goodness and gentleness and self-control. That all of these other fruit are based on the interaction and service that these main functions have concerning each other. And so without these three functions being well-ordered and properly oriented toward others and to the benefit of others and the service of others and even the service of each other, you are not going to have all the benefits of the fruit of the Spirit. So with that as a backdrop, we can begin to talk about the disorders of the powers, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit more in coming episodes or touch back on some of these ideas. To begin, if there are three main spirit-led functions, then there are probably also three main dysfunctions of the three powers. So for full disclosure, I read about this in a book by Douglas M. Jones called Dismissing Jesus, which I do recommend. And it is a book about how we basically set aside the way of the cross in order to pursue one of these classic temptations. The classic temptations are power, prestige, and pleasure. Sometimes power, prestige, possessions, but we'll get into that a little bit more. Douglas M. Jones did not come up with this either. He's drawing most of this idea from the Grand Inquisitor parable from Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky, which if you haven't read that book, you should definitely try to get around to reading it. The Grand Inquisitor parable is one of the more famous passages from Dostoevsky. It's told by one of the three brothers, Karamazov, who's Ivan. He's the atheist. He's lost all faith in God and in other things, and is basically a nihilist. And he tells this parable to his pious brother, Alexei, or Alyosha. And he tells the story to challenge Alyosha's view of the world and challenge his view of religion. So in this parable, what happens is Jesus, apparently, came back in his second coming during the Inquisition. And he visits Seville during the Inquisition, and he's performing some miracles and is being recognized as the Christ and recognizes the second coming. And the Grand Inquisitor then arrests him and brings him before him and then basically says, "You, Jesus, I know who you are. I know that you are Jesus, but you made grave errors by rejecting the three temptations of Satan, and the church has corrected those errors. Whereas you rejected power and prestige and possessions, we have embraced power and prestige and possessions in order to accomplish your purported goals. And you rejected those ways, and we've embraced those ways. And so, in order to keep you from getting in our way, we're going to have to re-crucify you." And so Jesus is put to death yet again by the Grand Inquisitor during the Inquisition as a way of keeping the church protected from Jesus' subversive ways. This story is obviously disturbing, and it's created a lot of thought since it came out. But Dostoevsky here is also making a lot out of the three temptations that Jesus received from Satan. The three temptations of Jesus are recorded in Matthew and in Luke with a slightly different order. But in Matthew, you have the temptation to turn the stones into bread, which Jesus rejects with a quotation from Deuteronomy, "Man shall not live by bread alone." And then you have the temptation to throw himself from the pinnacle of the temple. If he is in fact the Son of God, then the angels will bear him up. Jesus replies to this temptation also by quoting from Deuteronomy when he says, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test." And then the third temptation, in Matthew anyway, is when Jesus is brought to the top of a mountain and Satan says, "Bow before me and I will give you all the kingdoms of the earth." And Jesus replies, "You shall have no other gods but God and serve him only." And again, that's a quote from Deuteronomy. And if this were a podcast particularly on the three temptations of Jesus, I would talk about how powerful and ironic it is that Jesus quotes from the basic and most basic of the Torah in his replies to Satan. But for now, I'll just focus on the ways in which theologians and commentators have drawn from those three temptations these three larger human temptations of power, prestige, and possessions. The possessions, or pleasure, is the temptation to bread, where after fasting for 40 days, Jesus has hunger, and Satan is trying to tempt him to give in to that hunger, and even to use his divine power in order to feed himself. And he says, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but rather by every word which proceeds from God's mouth." So he resists that temptation to pleasure or possessions. The second temptation, when he is called to cast himself off the pinnacle of the temple, if he is in fact the Son of God, then God will bear him up. This is a desire to establish his own name or his own status or prestige as the Son of God, and to confirm that through a test of God, which he rightly says we're not supposed to do from the law. In the third temptation, he is granted the possibility of power, the possibility of power over all the kingdoms of the world, if only he submits himself to Satan and worships Satan. And he resists that temptation as well. So you can see each of the classic temptations would be a particular temptation to one of the three powers more than the others. So the temptation to power, it's obvious that that would be the temptation of the will, as opposed to patience and hope, where you refrain from doing evil or you wait for the good. Power is the taking of the good because you can, and the delivering of the harm because you can, without any consideration of the right or the law of God. That would require self-control or self-restraint, which is the true function of the will. And so in this sense, the will overflows its boundaries and shows its nature in its power to do and to choose rather than in its power to wait and to persevere. And you can see that the pleasure, again, the temptation to pleasure, is going to affect the affections more than anything else, because the affections are supposed to be interested in the love or pleasure of others, but when it becomes self-oriented, it becomes interested in its own pleasure and in its own possessions rather than in the pleasure and possessions and blessing of others. Now, the last one is a little bit harder to see, and if you're thinking, well, prestige or fame is the only one left, but it doesn't really seem how that would be appealing to the fleshly intellect, I will say one of the things you need to understand about the intellect is that its desire is to name. So to know is in some ways to name. It's to give the proper name to the things that are around you. So if you're supposed to be naming and knowing others, and the temptation would then be for the intellect to be turned toward itself, where it is naming and knowing itself, as opposed to naming and knowing others. And you can see in this, then, that the intellect, when it's turned in on itself, would be interested in establishing its own name, in establishing its own value or own superiority over other people. So the classic temptations, then, are directly in contradiction to the proper spiritual functions of the three powers, and they produce, within each lead power, a certain kind of tyranny of that particular power, meaning that rather than partnering with the secondary power and serving, loving, caring, and lifting up in dignity the subject power, there becomes a certain tyranny that occurs for the leader power that begins to exploit the partner power and then abuse the subject power. And you can see this in many different cases, but let's take an example. In the story of Naboth's vineyard, you have Ahab, who is a whiny, petulant, selfish king, and his queen, Jezebel, who is clearly a evil, powerful woman who does great harm to others. And then you have their relationship to all the prophets. So what's clear in these circumstances is that Jezebel is truly the one who wears the pants in the family, and that Ahab is the exploited secondary person in that relationship, and the prophets obviously are all abused by both of them. And I like to think of this picture as being the picture of a disordered throne room of the spirit. In the Sword of Throne Room, you have a picture of a disordered person and not just of a disordered kingdom. And in that case, you'd have on top the abusive, tyrannical power of the will, who is Jezebel. She justifies the exercise of her power by the excuse that she is merely doing the desire of the affections, in this case of King Ahab, who whinily talks about how he wants this vineyard so that he can turn it into a little cucumber field. And Naboth won't give it to him. And so she, in rejection of truth and rejection of reality, says that Naboth is actually a vile criminal who needs to be put to death. They put him to death. They steal to fulfill his desire for good for me now. And then they reject the witness and the testimony of the prophets, either by killing them or just rejecting what they have to say and not listening to them. So you see in that sort of picture of a disordered person and the way that a disordered person could function. And it is sometimes difficult to determine who's in charge there, but I think from that story you can see that Jezebel is definitely in charge, and she is exploiting the desire of the king in order to give her own actions legitimacy. Whenever you're assessing or considering disorders of the powers, it's really important to understand that the external behaviors that are being done could be motivated for a lot of different reasons. Any sin, basically, when viewed from the outside, is going to look the same, whether it's motivated by a disorder of the affections or a disorder of the will or a disorder of the intellect. And so it's important not to just look at a sin and say, oh, that sin is obviously motivated by this because of the way that I view the motivation for those kinds of sins. For instance, sexual sin could be motivated by any three, and I'll show you how. You might think that because sex is pleasurable, that the main motivation for pursuing it would be pleasure, and that most sexual sin would be a disorder of the affections. But oftentimes, a person pursues an adulterous affair for the sense of control or power that they experience, either over other people or over their spouse or any of these kinds of things. Or sometimes with the most perverse of sexual sin, it truly is just a sense of domination or control where the exercise of power has become the source of the pleasure in that particular sin. And in that case, the pleasure itself in terms of the affections is not really what's being pursued, but rather it is this disorder of the will and its desire for power that is being pursued. It's also possible for sexual sin to be motivated by a desire for status or one's own name, and I'll give you an example of that. Friedrich Nietzsche, the famed philosopher and infamous megalomaniac and narcissist, apparently had a fairly long, many, many decades running infatuation with this woman, Cosima Wagner, who was first the mistress and then the wife of Richard Wagner, who Nietzsche, as you may know, had a very conflicted feeling about. Nietzsche considered Wagner to be a really powerful figure. Nietzsche wanted to exercise his own superiority over Wagner, even writing later in his life pieces like Nietzsche Contra Wagner, where he tried to show that Wagner's work was actually low-minded and bad. But he was obsessed with Cosima, this woman who was attached to Wagner. And I'm convinced that the reason for that was a desire to prove his superiority over Wagner. If he could only draw Cosima away from Wagner, then he himself, Nietzsche, would prove himself in that action to be superior to Wagner. And so I think that that had a whole lot more to do with a desire for status and self-confirmation than it did for a desire for pleasure. In fact, if he had been able to actually get Cosima, I think he would have become bored with that really fast and probably would have discarded her very quickly after that. So you can see that either power or pleasure or prestige could motivate a sin, like a sexual sin or any number of other sins. It's important not to view these things just from the external behavior. If you're falling into these sins regularly, it's for this particular reason. It's not necessarily the case. I also need to be careful. I am not saying that power or pleasure or prestige are necessarily bad things, but they are ways in which we are tempted away from the goal, standard, and function that we are supposed to be pursuing in communion with the Holy Spirit. So if you have power, if you have pleasurable things in your life, or if you have prestige or fame or recognition to some extent, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with those things. At the same time, the attempt to keep those things and maintain those things, even to the exclusion of pursuing the benefit of others or our love of God, obviously is where this disorder occurs. So when we're talking about a temptation, it's not that having any power, having any pleasure, having any prestige is intrinsically wrong. It's more that you need to be careful and you need to be aware that because of your particular power distributions, there are going to be temptations that are much more effective in getting you to sin. If you lift up your subject power will more than likely help you in protecting your primary power from becoming exclusive and tyrannical in the way that it exercises its own functions, goals, and standards. It's also important to note that if you are abusing your subject power, if the leader power or the partner power is abusing the subject power, or the leader power is exploiting the secondary power, the partner power, it is likely that you are going to do the same thing to other people. However your community internally and individually is organized, that's also the way you're probably going to try to organize your community outside of yourself. And so if you have learned how to abuse yourself, how to abuse a power in yourself, then when you see that power exercised around you, you are also going to abuse it in other people. And another way of saying that is you're going to abuse other people. So for instance, Ahab and Jezebel didn't probably begin persecuting prophets outside of them until they had already learned and established a great habit within themselves of rejecting and persecuting the intellectual information that was coming to them from within. And you can see how this would work out in a community, especially if they have a primary power that the community has said is the most important or most primary power. Any person in that community who displays the what should be, quote unquote, the primary power as a subject power, and who might even have the subject power of the community as his primary power or her primary power, that person is going to particularly be abused or likely to be abused or likely to be dismissed or likely to be devalued in that particular community. And so because of this, each of us has a responsibility to lift up in ourselves those powers that we might consider the weakest or the least important of our powers in many ways so that we can learn how to appreciate those powers when they exhibit themselves in great strength in other people, so that we can use our strengths to serve the weaknesses of others, and so that we can submit ourselves in our weakness to the strength of others. Let me give you an example of how this happened in me. And this is a little bit of a confessional. My father is the most disciplined, well-ordered will I have ever known. He has done the same routine with almost robotic consistency for decades. If he says he's going to be home at a certain time, he will be home at that time to the minute. That is how he has always been, exceedingly, exceedingly reliable and dependable. Very much a rule follower, very loyal, dogged, persevering, an extraordinary specimen of extraordinary will. My subject power is the will. My primary power is the intellect, partnered very closely with my affections. So when I was younger, and I was trying to be as much a brain on a stick as I possibly could be, I tended to devalue the will. And because I devalued it in myself, and I also devalued the affections early on in my teenage years, I was basically a functional sociopath, as you probably recognize from that article I wrote. So I did not greatly value my father. In fact, I used to quote to his face a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said that foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. And I used to think that of my father, that he had a little mind, that because of my relatively superior understanding and his obsession and reliance on the crutch of discipline and schedule, that he truly was an inferior person to me, and I despised him in my heart. It took a long time, and God had to humble me and break me down a lot before I finally realized, no, I need to honor my father in my heart. I began to honor him, and I started to realize what an extraordinary and powerful and wonderful person he truly was. And I began to recognize that I was setting aside my own weakness. I was dismissing my own weakness in the area of will as being a non-factor in my life, and really blaming circumstances and other people who are all inferior and plebeian and part of the masses, etc. And all of that really was a cope for how weak I thought of myself, and really for the abuse and self-loathing that I had turned in on myself for this particular power that really was not great then and probably never will be great. And it was always being compared to my father's greatness. And that in my pride, I wanted to reject that. And I did that by trying to put him down and make him feel like he was worthless, and by treating him like he was worthless. It wasn't until I learned to honor him that I truly began to learn the value of even my own will, and started to raise up and strengthen my capacity for self-discipline and scheduling and holding my ground and setting good boundaries. So it really could go either way when you have a massive disorder like this, which is usually caused by the tyranny of one of your lead powers. It is important both to resolve that self-loathing and that self-abuse or that self-dismissal or that jealousy or resentment that's going on inside of you that is causing this disorder. And also, and it may be that once you do that work internally, that that will turn itself into the ability to love and to consider as important other people who may not have the same powers you do in the same abundance or in the same relative order. Or it could be that by learning to honor other people and really pursuing the honor of other people, you also learn to establish even within yourself some degree of self-acceptance for the way that you are ordered naturally and for the way that God has made you to fulfill your particular purpose. And whichever way you go, whether you start from within yourself and work out or start from out and work in, eventually you're going to create a more harmonious and a more functional community. And you're also going to create a more harmonious and more functional relationship of your powers even within yourself. So I hope that's helpful. If you have any questions or comments, again, you can leave them on my website on this episode. And thank you all again so much for listening and for engaging. I really do appreciate it.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.